Hi and welcome to the Biographics Podcast. I am your host, Simon Whistler, and in today's episode, we've got another one we've taken from our YouTube channel. If there are any sort of weird abnormalities, because this is the taking of a video from YouTube and the rebroadcasting of the audio in a podcast form, if there's anything weird and funky, that's probably just because it was intended for a video audience first, but hopefully you will enjoy it all the same. Let's roll into today's episode. In the 125 years since Alfred Nobel's estate first established the Nobel Prize, Cambridge University has had a remarkable group of laureates honored for their work. Their names are synonymous with excellence and innovation. Bertrand Russell, Francis Crick, Niels Bohr, Milton Friedman. There are literally 100 more. Yet, despite all those brilliant minds that have walked the Cambridge grounds, only one of them has ever won 2 Nobel Prizes. He marched into an unknown branch of science, which few even knew existed at the time, and blazed a trail for those who would come after him. He wildly expanded the definitions of what we knew about genetics and human existence. He kickstarted a scientific revolution that has raged well into the 21st century. And incredibly, he did all of that with the humility of a man who was just tinkering with some toys in his garage. His name was Frederick Sanger, and his brilliant career in biochemistry shaped the modern world. Frederick Sanger was born August the 13th, 1918, in the village of Rendcombe in Gloucestershire, England. His father, who was also named Frederick, was a physician who had studied at St. John's College, Cambridge. Fred Sr. was something of an innovator himself. Long before his son started investigating peptide chains, he worked with Scotland Yard to develop a forensic test that could differentiate between human blood and animal blood. More than a decade before he had any children, Fred Sr. traveled to China as an Anglican medical missionary. He served a local community in a mission hospital, spreading the gospel wherever he could. But in 1912, with the country on the brink of revolution and Frederick in poor health, he returned to England to open his own practice. It was here that he met the love of his life, Cecily Crewdson, in the most romantic way possible. He was called to treat her septic finger. They married in 1916, and Cecily gave birth to 2 sons, Theo and Frederick, over the next 2 years. Fred Sr. and Theo both had a tremendous impact on the direction of Frederick Sanger's life. Theo loved nature, and so he often brought along his younger brother for outdoor adventures and animal investigations. The boys would hunt for newts in the family pond or scour the yard for birds' nests. Between his father, the doctor, and his brother, the naturalist, Frederick couldn't help but develop a scientific curiosity, a thirst for discovering the nature of things. Whether they intended to or not, the elder men of his household pushed him towards rational investigation, even at a young age. The other early influence on Frederick's life was religion. Although his father had left China as a Protestant, by the time Theo and Frederick were running around the yard, the household had distinct Quaker influences. Cecily's father was a wealthy cotton merchant, and when he passed away, he left the Sangers both money and religious reading material. Perhaps because of his time in China, which featured simmering revolutionary violence and distrust of Protestant missionaries, Fred Sr. found the Quaker perspective appealing. He converted, and in 1923, he moved the now family of 5 to Tanworth in Arden, near Birmingham, to be close to a stronger Quaker community. Quaker beliefs colored most aspects of young Frederick's childhood. He and his siblings were always taught to say their prayers. When they reached school age, Frederick was tutored by a Quaker governess. In 1927, at the age of 9, Frederick was shipped off to boarding school. His destination? A Quaker school, known then as Downs Preparatory School. He stayed there until 1932, when he began boarding at Bryanston School in Dorset. It was at Bryanston where Sanger's Quaker roots were finally joined with his budding love, science. At Bryanston, Sanger began to flourish as a student of the sciences. Bryanston operated on a less structured educational system than many of its peer institutions at the time. Instead of crushing its pupils with structure and discipline, the school allowed students to work on a more flexible schedule, offering free periods and allowing the boys themselves to prioritize which subjects they wanted to focus on. Additionally, there was a new headmaster, Thorold Code, who eliminated the popular practice of beating. Instead, his administration chose to emphasize growth through self-discipline. So while the school has a record of some boys taking advantage of their new freedom by lollygagging around, the shift away from teaching through violence was undoubtedly a boon to a young Quaker like Fred Sanger, who began to prefer the benefits of self-guided tinkering and experimentation. Sanger reportedly enjoyed a good relationship with Fraser Hyland, the Branston biology master, who would often take the boys out on adventures in nature. He got along even better with the chemistry master, Henry Jeffrey Ordish, a man who was an accomplished photographer, electrician, and motorcyclist. He ran the chemistry lab at Branston, which he had personally renovated and wired inside a portion of an old stable. Sanger's quietly surging aptitude for the sciences, propped up by Branston's emphasis on self-discipline and individual work, put him on a trajectory towards success. At the time, boarders set to take and pass their school certificate to graduate and qualify for university, and Sanger spent so much time working and studying alongside Hyland and Ordish that he took and passed his certificate a year early. As if that wasn't enough, he scored 7 credits on his exam, which was, at the time, the highest score in the history of the school. While most of his peers were stressing over their own certificate, Sanger had a final year to tinker in the school laboratories and think about his future, free of any pressure from exams. His father expected him to become a doctor and continue the Sanger family legacy, and with high test marks and a natural aptitude for the sciences, this was arguably the most logical choice. Frederick considered his options during his free year while continuing to conduct experiments with Ordish in the stable lab. In 1936, he applied to St. John's College at Cambridge. It was the natural choice for Sanger, as it was the very same school attended by his father, his uncle, and his most influential teacher. With his strong test scores, his acceptance was all but a formality. His choice of studies, on the other hand, well, that was quite up in the air. Frederick arrived at the conclusion that his father's career, while rewarding, would not enable him the sort of intellectual freedom he had grown accustomed to in his formative years. His father was always running around, checking on patients, serving the community. To him, that sounded burdensome. As he had throughout his childhood, Frederick the Younger wanted to explore. So when he arrived at Cambridge, he placed himself in a natural sciences course track, studying chemistry, physics, and maths. He found himself intrigued with the ideas of Ernest Baldwin, one of his university teachers, who proposed that solving certain mysteries in the world of chemistry might unlock new understanding of biological systems. As Sanger marched through his university education, he continued to gravitate toward the emerging field of biochemistry. Prior to the 20th century, science and technology hadn't yet advanced far enough for mankind to really understand the extent of the relationship between biology and chemistry, but by the late 1930s, Sanger and his mentors were beginning to inch towards a complete understanding of the living world. By the time he completed his bachelor's degree in 1939, though, biochemistry wasn't the only thing inching closer towards Frederick Sanger. Europe had become embroiled in World War II, and scientists and science departments everywhere were turning their focus away from lab experiments towards the growing Axis threat in Europe. Sanger was no stranger to the Nazis. During his free year at Branston, he had spent a few weeks at a partner boarding school called Schulschloss Salem in southern Germany as part of an exchange program. He saw firsthand how German students were told to open their day with prayers, then follow them with a reading from Mein Kampf. His religious sensibilities found this juxtaposition to be quite shocking. As a Quaker, though, his position on war was clear. He had affirmed his religious upbringing at university by becoming a member of the Peace Pledge Union and associated with an anti-war group within Cambridge's family of scientists. So, when Britain declared war on Germany in 1939, Sanger wasn't just avoiding conflict. He was a true, well-established pacifist, and he had the receipts to prove it. After appearing before a military tribunal, he was granted conscientious objector status. Even if Sanger wasn't going to war, though, the war was going to come to him. After taking an extra biochemistry class at Cambridge, he was temporarily dispatched to Winford Hospital in 1940 to help staff a war hospital as an orderly. After a few months, he was able to return to Cambridge, where he began gearing up for his PhD. Sanger hunkered down in his beloved biochemistry department, partnering up with Albert Neuberger as his mentor. Together, the pair undertook a study that focused on two fascinating subjects: lysine metabolism and the nitrogen content of a potato. Now, I realize that no one comes to Biographics for our expert analysis of protein synthesis, but I'll try and do my very best to at least nod in the direction of Sanger's thesis work. Lysine is one of 9 essential amino acids, meaning it's required for human function, but it isn't efficiently produced in the human body in mass quantities. In other words, this means that it's something we have to incorporate into our diets. In the case of lysine, it's often consumed via meat, eggs, beans, or lentils, and the body uses it to synthesize key proteins. Sanger tried to unravel the nature of lysine metabolism in a complex series of experiments centered around feeding it to rats. His experiments were inconclusive. The scientific community didn't know enough about amino acids or proteins at that point, and it would be another 30 years before biochemists would unlock the lysine mystery. But Sanger nonetheless received credit for his thesis. This was called the metabolism of the amino acid lysine in the animal body. He defended his work to Charles Harrington and Albert Charles Chibnall in 1943, receiving his PhD at the age of 26. At the same time he was crafting his thesis, he and Neuberger began a separate experiment aimed at aiding the war effort, and it examined variation in nitrogen levels for different types of domestic potatoes. Sanger eventually described the potato experiment as one that was completed for more practical problems. The paper was published in Biochemical Journal in September 1942. As if Sanger didn't have enough going on in his life, while he was earning degrees, writing theses, and supporting war hospitals, he was also falling in love. Sanger had met Joan Margaret Howe through an anti-war group while pursuing his bachelor's at Cambridge. While he was tulling away at St. John's College, Joan was a Leicester transplant studying economics. They grew close when Sanger lost both of his parents within a year of each other halfway through undergrad. They were married soon after the war started, on December the 28th, 1940, at St. Mary's Church in Side. Later, as he was preparing to defend his doctorate in 1943, he and Joan were also preparing to welcome their first child, Robin, into the world. 1943 is when it all changed for Sanger. It wasn't just the baby or the PhD. He also began to earn money as a professional scientist. Up until that point, Sanger had enjoyed a comfortable life as a student thanks to his family's wealth and, eventually, the inheritance bequeathed from his parents. Finally, in 1943, Sanger began drawing a real salary thanks to the Bate Memorial Fellowship for Medical Research, which subsidized Sanger's research into the 1950s. With his PhD firmly in hand, Sanger turned around and began working with the same man who'd signed off on his doctorate, newly minted Cambridge biochemistry professor A.C. Chibnall. Chibnall's research group at Cambridge was one of the foremost groups of experts on protein chemistry in the world, and they were determined to crack the mysteries behind how proteins did what they did. Not all scientists at the time even believed proteins could be mapped or studied, but Chibnall believed that they could. Thus, his team got to work. The team had already been studying insulin when Sanger joined the group, so he assigned himself the task of isolating and identifying the free amino groups of insulin. Through trial and error, Sanger developed a method using a chemical called dinitrofluorobenzene, which was a molecule specifically crafted to break insulin down into smaller chains of amino acids. Once he had broken it down into smaller pieces, he began using a brand new cutting-edge technique called partition chromatography to break down the amino acid chains even further. Sanger was eventually left with just 2 sets of terminal amino groups, phenylalanine and glycine, which suggested to our brilliant scientist that insulin is the product of 2 separate amino acids. Okay, now, unless you're an actual biochemist, there's a chance that you don't have the first idea of what any of that meant. And that's okay, I'm sure you're sharp as a tack in whatever it is you do for a living. All you really need to know about our boy Frederick here is that with careful experimentation over the course of a decade, he went farther in his understanding of basic protein structure than any human ever had before. And he accomplished it all simply by doing what he did best, standing at his workbench, tinkering with science. By the time Sanger had established he knew for sure that insulin had 2 distinct unchanging peptide chains, he had already shocked the scientific world. At the time, which was only 75 years ago, the scientific community had yet to prove that proteins were made up of specific sequences and not randomized or ever-changing amino groups. By the 1950s, he had attracted other scientists to help him completely map the entire insulin protein. Again, Sanger recognized the usefulness of new applications like paper chromatography and acid hydrolysis, and used these modern allowances to his advantage. He partnered with Australian biochemist E.O.P. Thompson to fully map insulin's A chain that ends in glycine. Similarly, he partnered with Austrian Hans Tuppy to map the B phenylalanine chain. This was the first time anyone had ever mapped a full protein, completely redefining modern science's vision of what biochemists could uncover.
I mean, I didn't have any sort of grand ideas like sitting down and saying I'm going to sequence a whole protein or anything like that. I mean, that makes a good story.
By 1958, Frederick Sanger's world had evolved quite a bit in the 15 years since his PhD. Joan had given birth again to a son named Peter in 1946. The Medical Research Council had offered him a paid research position in 1951. Archer Martin and Richard Synge, the inventors of partition chromatography, had won the 1952 Nobel Prize in Chemistry. Dinitrofluorobenzene, the original chemical that Frederick used to break up insulin, had been christened Sanger's regent. Then, finally, in 1958, the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences made official what everyone in the community seemed to already know. For revealing the full sequence of a protein and revolutionizing the human knowledge of proteins and their peptide chains, Frederick Sanger was awarded the Nobel Prize for Chemistry. Sanger wasn't done yet, though. If anything, his first Nobel validated his exploratory approach. Sanger wrote to his colleagues years later saying that the 1958 prize had an important and stimulating effect on my subsequent career. I had remained in Cambridge concentrating only on basic research and avoiding as far as possible teaching or administrative responsibilities. This recognition of my work gave me renewed confidence and enthusiasm to continue in this way of life, which I enjoyed. Sanger's insulin revelations had sent quakes through the adolescent biochemistry field. Ask any Brit about the revolution of the 1960s and they'll probably tell you everything you wanted to know about John Lennon or Roger Daltrey. But quietly, while the Kinks were ripping fresh chords in North London, the molecular revolution was well underway inside the halls of Cambridge laboratories. 2 years after his final child, Sally, was born in 1960, Sanger moved into the Medical Research Council's swanky new Cambridge facility, the Laboratory of Molecular Biology. Sanger, for his part, was the head of the protein division, but he was hardly the only big name in the building. Just a few years before CREAM formed in 1966, Cambridge was putting together a supergroup of their very own. Sanger, Aaron Klug, Max Perutz, John Kendraw, and Francis Crick all began working out of the LMB building, and they had an unreal opening salvo. Perutz and Kendraw won the 1962 Nobel Prize for Chemistry by expanding on Sanger's earlier work, studying the structures of globular proteins. Crick won an even more high-profile Nobel in 1962 as he and American partner James Watson uncovered the double helix structure of DNA, winning the Nobel Prize for Physiology and Medicine. The lab halls in the LMB were absolutely booming, cranking out new revelations about the nature of life faster than the scientific community could process them. After Watson and Crick's DNA projection, much of the team's focus moved from amino acids and proteins to nucleic acids and genetic material. With all the discovery going on around him, Sanger began to feel his interests pulling in a new direction. Just as he had spent hours tinkering around, unraveling the secrets of proteins, he now wanted to investigate the nature of nucleic acids. Sanger viewed an investigation into genetics as the natural evolution of his investigation into proteins. He spent much of the 1960s solely sequencing messenger RNA, which, in case you've forgotten your health sciences from primary school, is sort of like DNA's little brother that helps synthesize new proteins. In the 1960s, Sanger and his peers didn't really know that, though, which was why there was such a push to study nucleic acids in the first place. By the early 1970s, several biochemists from around the world had used in vitro protein synthesis to reverse engineer how proteins developed on nucleotides, and Sanger's completed sequences helped confirm the first round of RNA hypotheses. With RNA now at least partially unlocked, Sanger wanted to move on to studying the white whale of the late 20th century, genomics mapping and DNA. Despite 3 decades of Sanger pioneering the science of organic sequencing, no one had really attempted to map human DNA. And there was a very good reason for this. DNA strands, even for non-humans, are massive. We're talking about thousands of nucleotides for bacteria, millions for most complex organisms, and billions for primates. So before he could even think about sequencing anything, Frederick Sanger had to do what he did best: play around in his lab and invent some brand new scientific methodology. By 1975, Sanger had the beginnings of a plan. He began using a manipulated nucleotide called a deoxynucleotide to chop down DNA strands into pieces that were a few hundred nucleotides long rather than tens of thousands. The deoxy had a similar chemical structure to a regular nucleotide, but with one key difference. It could peel chains off, separating them from the rest of the double helix. If Sanger repeated the process enough times, he could sequence an entire organism's DNA. And that was exactly what he did. Slowly but surely, he completed the mapping out of 5,375 nucleotides of bacteriophage Phi X174 in 1977. It was the first DNA genome to ever be sequenced. Once again, Sanger had embarked on a 15-year scientific odyssey, starting with Watson and Crick's double helix discovery back in 1962, that culminated in a seminal moment in human scientific discovery. Sanger Phi's 174 genome had virtually no practical application, but it did represent a gateway to the idea that human genetics could realistically be sequenced and studied. The first team through the gateway, unsurprisingly, was Sanger's Cambridge gang. After successfully tackling a bacterial genome, they moved on to map the 16,000 nucleotides in human mitochondrial DNA and the 48,000 nucleotides in bacteriophage lambda, finishing those projects over the next few years. By 1980, the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences was ready to place Sanger's name in incredibly rare air. For massive contributions to the booming scientific field of DNA sequencing, the 1980 Nobel Prize for Chemistry was awarded to Sanger and his sequencing partner Walter Gilbert for their work with nucleotide bases. American biochemist Paul Berg received credit on the award as well for his parallel work on nucleotides and recombinant DNA. This was an unprecedented move from the Nobel Committee, as only four individuals had ever won multiple Nobels: Marie Curie for physics and chemistry, John Bardeen twice for physics, and Linus Pauling for chemistry and peace. Sanger became the fourth and final member of the exclusive multiple Nobel Club. It's a fitting honor for a man who approached his research with a quiet, relentless dignity. During his 1980 Nobel speech, Sanger explained, "I believe that we have been doing this not primarily to achieve riches or even honor, but rather because we were interested in the work, enjoyed doing it, and felt very strongly that it was worthwhile." It was a classic line from a classic scientist, one who knew even from an early age that playing around at a lab bench was its own reward. Fred Sanger retired in 1983, just 3 years after his second Nobel Prize. 40 years of revolutionary lab work had been enough for him. He wanted to go home, spend time with his wife and grandchildren, and work in his garden. Sanger remained disarmingly humble about his career, which, by all accounts, was filled with revolutionary discoveries and near superhuman levels of persistence. Beyond his two Nobels, he was elected a member of the Royal Society in 1954 and Order of the Companions of Honor in 1981. He was named a Commander of the Order of the British Empire, awarded the Copley Medal and the Order of Merit. Oh, and in 1993, when the British Medical Research Center moved to establish a genome research center, they named it the Sanger Institute. All this from a man who fondly referred to his career as just a chap messing about in a lab. Sanger did enjoy working on projects, which is partially why he began looking forward to his retirement so much. He wanted to swap his beakers for a boat. And so he did, quietly spending the final three decades of his life enjoying time with his family, growing plants in his garden, and, by his own words, messing about in boats. Sanger lived a long and full life, enjoying plenty of time with his grandchildren and eventually seeing his work with DNA sequencing fully realized. 20 years after his retirement in 2003, an extraordinary international team of scientists completed their work on the human genome, having completely mapped out every nucleotide responsible for human genetics. And it had all started decades earlier, with Sanger, a Cambridge laboratory, and an insatiable curiosity for knowledge. Sanger's wife, Joan, died in 2012, and Sanger passed away the following year, on November the 19th, 2013. He was 95. The world mourned a titan of 20th century science. The New York Times labeled him a genetic pioneer, while Scientific American crowned him the father of DNA sequencing. It's an appropriate title for a man whose influence reverberates throughout the history of science. Sanger's work with proteins ignited a revolution so vast, we still haven't fully completed the results nearly 75 years down the road. His 1977 DNA paper on the Didioxy sequencing method, also called the Sanger method, has been formally cited by other scientific publications more than 73,000 times. The Cambridge Laboratory for Molecular Biology has continued to churn out Nobel laureates. The British press actually refers to it as the Nobel Factory. But even there, no one is equaled Frederick Sanger's achievements. His astounding life of peerless achievement leaves us all with a critical question of self-examination. If we all sat down with a goal in mind and messed about until we got it right, what could we accomplish? So I really hope you enjoyed that episode. You listened all the way through, so hopefully you really liked it. If you did, why not go over to iTunes and leave us a review? It does make a huge difference. If you want it to be 5 stars, that is amazing, but give it whatever you felt we deserve. As always, I'll be back next time with another brand new episode, and thank you for listening.